while everyone else paid the price. The fools overborrowed and overspent, in the end having only enough money left to service the interest on billions in foreign debt. Eventually, the economy crumbled, consumer goods vanished, and food went scarce, which allowed a wave of angry young people to mobilize, 10 million strong, and bring a government to its knees. He'd been part of that revolution. Now, he was the head of state. But for how much longer? Socialist? Anti-socialist? It was a question asked many times in the 1980s, but one that disappeared in the 1990s and now no longer mattered. Poland was free. Or was it? The pain in his chest felt like his heart was encased in barbed wire. Not a coronary. Just the past rearing its ugly head and reminding him that it still existed. He had to fix this. This had to end. And whatever was required to make that happen, he would do. Chapter 17. Cotton was led into the building and up a flight of stairs to a second-floor apartment full of nondescript furniture. The kind bought by cheap landlords who expect the worst from tenants. He caught a strong smell of mustiness and wondered if anyone lived there. A familiar face waited inside, one that ushered him in with a casual sweep of a big paw.
"Mr. Malone, good to see you again."
The feeling was not mutual. "What's it been, 3 years? Do people still call you Ivan? Or does that change by the assignment?"
"That is my name."
The last time he'd dealt with this devil, they'd talked within the shadow of the Round Tower in Copenhagen, then again in Amsterdam, the situation dire. But the rough English laced with a heavy Russian accent remained, as did the man's Cossack appearance, short, heavy-chested, with grayish-black hair. A splotchy, reddened skink of a face was still dominated by a broad nose and shadowed by a day-old beard. No slave to fashion, Ivan wore an ill-fitting suit that bulged at the waist. Cotton gestured over his shoulder at the two amigos standing behind him. "Your people stole the holy blood?"
"How is Cassiopeia?"
This guy had loved to ignore questions the first time they'd met, too.
"As I tell you back then, quite the woman," Ivan said. "If I am younger, 100 pounds lighter."
The Russian patted his belly.
"Who knows? But I am dreaming."
Ivan paused.
"I hope, like last time, you appreciate this problem too."
"It's the only reason I'm still standing here." His unspoken message seemed to be received. Get to the point. Ivan chuckled.
"You say same thing last time. Like then, you can overpower me. I am still fat, out of shape. Stupid too.
All Russians are, right?" He had a moment of déjà vu. To Amsterdam. Similar sarcasm. A similar implied threat. Since the two guys behind him then and now were not fat and out of shape.
"I hope you're still smart," Ivan said. "Years off job have not changed you. Last time, you did good."
That matter involved China, with Russia his reluctant ally. "I seem to be busier in retirement than when I was working for the government."
"That bad thing?"
He shrugged. "Depends. How do you know Sonia Draga?"
"We work together a few times. She make good bait."
That she did. He'd willingly taken that bait, though sensing the risk. "Why am I in the middle of this?" he asked. Ivan pointed.
"That your fault. You go after my men today, not your business." Or was it?
Now he understood the curiosity. An ex-American agent in the Basilica at just the right moment who gave chase, then ended up talking with Stephanie Nell and Mr. Deputy National Security. That 2 and 2, at least in Ivan's mind, added up to a big fat 4. So he decided, why not? Play along. "You get an invitation to the auction?"
"Me? No. People at Kremlin. They get invite and reply. We told to steal holy blood. What they tell you steal? The wait, Ivan said. Then he motioned at the amigos. Leave. The two men withdrew and closed the door. Apparently their clearance level wasn't high enough for that information. Go ahead, Ivan said. We were told to steal the nail at Bomberg. A lie. But hopefully this man had no way of knowing the truth. Time to see if this information route was a two-way street. Tell me what's up for auction. They not give you taste. I'm curious as to your sample. Ivan laughed. President of Poland has many secrets. Ones we were not even aware he had. Bad secrets. Unfortunate for him. Sadly, many of our records are gone. Perestroika, glasnost, thieves. Between them, we don't have much left. What kind of bad secrets? The kind he do not want people to ever know. That bad. Ivan rubbed his nose between thumb and forefinger, as if easing his sinuses. Plenty bad. He got it. Depending on who possessed the information, they could get the Polish president to do whatever they wanted, either to place missiles in Poland or not. Certainly Russia was in the no category, the United States in the yes. That was five of the seven possibilities. You know who else was invited? He asked. Ivan pointed. Just you. Rest is mystery. You went to a lot of trouble to get me here. I want message delivered to your people, one they will understand. Sonya can't be your errand girl. I'm retired and have nothing to do with any of this. You funny man. For once, Sonya and I find ourselves on same side. We want same thing. No missiles in Poland. Ivan gestured with his outstretched hands. Seems like good idea. And he agreed. But his patience had reached an end. Look, I just told you I have nothing to do with this. Yes, I was in the Basilica today and stuck my nose where it didn't belong. But that was me being the Lone Ranger. The White House just tried to recruit me and I said no. This is not my problem. Yet you are here. Good point. Okay. What's your message? Moscow not happy. They will not allow missiles in Poland, whatever that takes. No missiles, not ever. The tone had changed. No more frivolity. The mouth twisted into a sour line. This guy meant every word. We do whatever necessary to make sure that not happen. Winning auction might work. Killing might work too. Tell your people we do whatever necessary. We not start this. Your president start. But we shall finish. I have full authority to do that. Normally, he'd shake his head and leave. The U.S. government could handle things without his help. And who liked being an errand boy? But Stephanie was riding point on this one, and Bunch had already made clear that she was expendable. We not know where auction will occur, but when we do, we will act, Ivan said. Tell Stephanie now that I do not bluff. He did not like the sound of that. He'd had enough. I'm leaving now. Ivan shrugged. Then his hard face split into a toothy smile as he reached beneath his jacket, drew a gun, and fired. Chapter 18. Jonty followed Vic and Conrad down a black tunnel. The floor a succession of wooden planks, the walls strengthened by a thick timber lining. He understood the liberal use of wood. Plentiful in supply, it flexed with the earth's pressure and never corroded. The slow elevator ride down the shaft had taken 40 seconds, popping his ears. They were now 130 meters into the earth, on one of the mine's lower routes, far past the busy tourist areas higher up on levels 1 and 2.
Up there was a small city with 3 kilometers of tunnels that accommodated conference facilities, restaurants, bars, chapels, shops, even a sanatorium for chronic allergies, every chamber cut from the surrounding salt. Though not a working mine any longer, the whole place remained full of life. He'd visited all the public areas, but here in the dark solitude, the grayish-green salt, more like unpolished granite, seemed far more ancient, the surroundings a warren of tunnels and dangerous pitfalls. Conrad stopped and faced him and Vic, removing something from his pocket, a piece of paper that he unfolded.
"This is a map for this level."
They were dressed in coveralls. Each wore a carbon dioxide absorber. The only light on the map came from their helmet lamps, which collectively illuminated a printed maze of tunnels and chambers. The routes twisted, curved, and intersected like spaghetti. With so many chambers, it would be impossible to keep any of it straight if not for the fact that the vast majority were named. He noticed 5 red X's on the map beside labels. Conrad traced a route with his finger, following the X's.
Goembia, Barane, Soroki, Stigielitz, Yelen.
Pigeons, sheep, magpies, goldfinch, deer.
"The chambers and tunnels are named for animals, birds, famous visitors, cities, provinces, people. Even one for a dragon," Conrad said. "Most of the labels are centuries old, attached when they were first hewn from the salt."
"And what an endeavor."
Block by block, the salt had been removed, starting at the top and continuing down until a vein was tapped out, forming a chamber. Then the miners moved to the next, boring long, straight tunnels called drifts to connect the chambers, all done for not only excavation, but also better ventilation. The result was a maze, kilometers long, apparently made navigable only by the names attached along the way.
"The Baranya chamber is ahead," Conrad said. "It's the only one that intersects with this main drift. Vix said you needed a simple, clear path to find the end. Here it is."
Jonty had held off to the last minute with this final detail, now even more important given Reinhardt's presence. "Has anyone else inquired about this?" Conrad shook his head.
"No one."
"Do you know if anyone has been on this level the past few days?"
"Surely some of the miners have. But you can only get down here with a fob that frees the elevator. I have one, and about 50 others do too. We check every level daily. But if you're asking if anyone has gone to where we're headed, not to my knowledge. It's fairly remote and inaccessible. There's no reason for anyone to be there."
They continued down the timber-lined drift, the dry salt beneath their boots crunching with every step like packed snow. A steady breeze swept over them from the ventilation system, which helped alleviate any feeling of being entombed. The air was cool, but not uncomfortably so. Vic toted a backpack containing what would make Jonty rich. He'd decided weeks ago not to keep the cash exposed. Better to place it in a secure location and let the high bidder worry about its procurement. All 7 participants possessed resources to make that happen, along with the ability to hunt down and kill him if they did not get what they paid for. But he had no intention of cheating anyone. Quite the contrary. His reputation had been built on dependability, so he planned to offer Vix assistance if needed to secure what they'd paid for. Not quite a money-back guarantee, but close enough. They kept walking and entered another chamber. This one was huge, at least 20 meters high and more than that long and wide. He marveled at human industry. At one point, over 1/3 of the entire royal treasury of Poland had been derived from salt. 27 million tons extracted over 7 centuries, each block hacked from the wall with picks, axes, and wedges. Until the 14th century, prisoners of war worked the mine as slaves. Then freemen took over. And no brutality existed as it did in coal, gold, or other mines. Here there was a much more normal existence, The men living below for weeks at a time, working 8-hour shifts, being paid well, which included a generous salt allowance. The diggers had been the most important in the social hierarchy, and rightly so. Prospectors found the salt. Carriers moved the blocks from the drifts to the shafts so they could be hauled upward. Penitents had the toughest job of all, guarding against deadly methane gas, which seeped from the rock and accumulated at the ceiling. They wore soaking wet clothes and held long poles with torches on the end, burning off the gas before it became explosive. Water was the chief enemy, seeping down from above, forming brine, chiseling the salt from the ceilings and walls, crystallizing it into cauliflower-like glazes and stalactites, many visible here on this level, reflecting back from their helmet lights.
"This is Soroki," Conrad said. "It's one of the largest chambers on this level, but it's not in good shape, as you can see. Water is seeping in everywhere. Eventually, the miners will come and make repairs."
Rising on the far side were enormous logs, stacked horizontally onto one another, forming a table-like pillared wall, cribbing, there to counteract the enormous downward pressure from the rock and prevent collapse. He noticed the size of the tree trunks and that most bore no evidence of a saw. Instead, they'd been chopped down with an axe from the nearby forests, the hack marks still there, which confirmed they'd been there a long time. Yet they looked relatively recent, proof of the preservation effects a salt mine had on wood. It could last forever, provided it didn't burn. White paint helped make it more visible and retardant. Fire had always been the greatest threat. For centuries, miners worked with open lamps in clay bowls, tallow and oil for fuel, an easy matter for a spark to flare, the fire bringing not only flames and heat, but also noxious carbon monoxide. There'd been many fires in the mines over the centuries. Some were deadly and had lasted for months, as there was nothing that could be done except seal the area off and allow the flames to burn themselves out. He noticed that some of the cribbing showed traces of charring. Conrad led the way down another drift. Offshoots appeared periodically into more dark passages left and right. Some were labeled, most were not. Then a white sign with black letters noted that an offshoot to the right was named Stigielitz, Goldfinch. "That was marked on your map," he said to Conrad.
"That's right. It will get progressively tighter from here on. This is an area no one visits. It's known only through old charts and records."
Vic turned to face him with a look that asked if he was going to be okay.
"I've never been claustrophobic," Chanti said. "I'll be fine."
They kept going into the blackness, and he felt like he was descending into the abyss. Without their lights, they would not be able even to see a finger touch their nose. The passageway narrowed. They found a chamber marked Goembia, and finally came to one labeled Yelin. More names from the map. Ahead, the tunnel had fallen in on itself, leaving only a small hatchway through the salt debris, big enough for a man to pass through on his belly. A dark space opened on the other side. Vic nodded. Jaunty faced their guide.
"I need you to wait here. We need to handle this alone."
Conrad had the good sense not to argue, and simply nodded.
"I also need that map," Jaunty said.
Conrad handed it over. No sense delaying. This had to be done.
"Lead the way," he said to Vic.
Chapter 19. Cotton quickly corrected himself. Not a gun. A taser. Two barbed electrodes attached to conductors shot through the air. Their needles found his chest. Electricity surged through him. White-hot pain exploded in his brain, leaving a trail of quivering nerves in its path. His muscles overloaded and he collapsed to the floor, his body convulsing into contractions, like a leg cramp amplified 1,000 times. The weapon continued to click as high-voltage current passed through him. The feeling of helplessness and vulnerability seemed overwhelming. He had complete control over his mind, but not his body. The taser's clicking stopped. The whole thing lasted no more than 5 seconds,
but it had been the longest 5 of his life. He stayed conscious, aware of his surroundings, with only one thought: for the pain to stop. And it did. But he was immobile. He tried to catch his breath. Yvonne bent down and plucked out the darts. "Pass on message, Malone." Then the Russian left. Son of a bitch. That hurt. He slowly sat up. His head and mind felt dull and heavy. Damn it. He entered the small lobby of his hotel, a fine 18th-century burgher's house converted into a cozy, elegant establishment not far from the central market. On the walk over, his nerves had settled. He should call Stephanie and pass on the message, not because Yvonne wanted him to, but because she needed to know the lay of the land. He'd make that call after getting upstairs to his room, where he'd have some privacy. He remained hungry, and his hotel, though quaint and comfortable, provided no room service. He'd have to head back out to find a snack, which wouldn't be a problem given the number of nearby cafes. He retrieved the room key from the desk clerk and climbed 2 unbroken flights of wooden stairs to the 3rd floor, pulling himself along on the balustrade. He approached his door and opened the deadbolt. Inside, he tossed the key on the dresser. His room was a small suite with a separate area for the bed, a paneled door in between, which hung half open. No lights were on, the ambient light from outside leaking in through the windows, providing more than enough illumination. A noise came from the other room. A squeak. Then another. Somebody was there. He approached the doorway, staying to one side. Only an idiot rushed into the dark, so he reached around the jamb and flicked the wall switch. The room lit with the soft amber glow from 2 lamps on the nightstands. In the bed, her back propped on a pillow, lay Sonia Draga. Back when he was still with the Magellan billet, during the years he lived apart from his wife, Sonia had been quite a temptation, one he'd succumbed to on more than one occasion. Those encounters had not been without passion, though more a uniting of kindred seekers, 2 drifting souls who took comfort in each other since they both seemed to understand loneliness. But that was all in the old days, B.C., before Cassiopeia. Things were different now. "Yvonne asked for a favor, and I obliged," she said. "He promised he'd behave. Did he?" He walked over and sat on the bed, noticing that she'd removed her shoes, her toenails painted blood red. "He tasered me." She touched his arm. "Would you like me to make it better? My way of apologizing." He needed to say something to bridge that clumsy gap between offer and caress. Years ago, as a young Navy lawyer, he'd made the mistake of cheating on his wife. Why? Looking back, he had no idea. It just happened. A stupid act. A vain attempt at thinking someone else cared, finding pleasure in them, if only for a moment, regardless of the consequences. He hurt Pam more than he ever thought possible, and she repaid him with a child that he only learned years later was not biologically his. It took more than a decade to end that civil war. He and Pam now got along just fine. Gary, their son, knew the truth, and had come to terms with the fact that though he may not be a Malone by blood, he was in every other meaningful way. More important, his own feelings had finally come into focus. Cassiopeia was important to him. She meant something. She laughed at his jokes, admired his intelligence, sympathized with his hurts, and shared his passions, as he did with hers. She was his best friend, and that realization came with a warmth and fullness, a sense of belonging, of a purpose intertwined. He loved Cassiopeia, and she loved him. How did that happen? Hell, if love could be predicted, it would lose all of its power. All he knew was that he did. "Sorry, Sonia. I'm not available." She tossed him a puzzled look. "Has Cotton Malone found someone?" "You sound surprised. I never thought you the domesticated type." She was gorgeous, with a petite rounded face, a buttoned chin, and a small upturned nose that made her far more pretty than glamorous. Centered between high cheeks was a small but expressive mouth. Her body had not a drop of fat or excess. Her eyes, blue to green, changing with her mood, reflected a lot about her, everything casting an air that was quintessentially feminine. One he knew was somewhat of an illusion, since this woman could definitely hurt you. "I found someone myself," she said. "Yet here you are in my bed, fully clothed. This is business." And she smiled, her puckered mouth dimpled at the corners. "What do you want, Sonia?"
"The United States needs to avoid the auction, walk away. With America's departure, the value of that information diminishes greatly for Jonty Olivier."
Interesting. She knew the seller, but he understood. Olivier needs the haves and the have-nots. Both affect the price, and America is the biggest have. "Did Poland get an invite?"
She shook her head. "Hence my alliance with Ivan. We needed a little help from someone who thinks like we do on this issue."
"No missiles." She nodded. "What did your president do that's so bad?" She tossed him a quizzical look.
"Tom Bunch didn't tell you."
He decided to be honest. "Not a word." She smiled, her teeth white as pearls.
"Is it tough being out of the loop?"
"Not at all. The tough part comes when someone wants you in the loop, but tells you nothing."
"Are you in this?"
He knew the rules. No information to outsiders. No need. They're not in the game. But players. They were different, and sometimes you had to cast your net wider than usual to see what could be reeled in. "I haven't decided."
"Ivan said you weren't all that receptive."
He smiled. "You and he have quite the relationship."
"Those missiles are a dead issue that your president has resurrected. Russia doesn't want them in Poland, nor do they want to spend the tens of millions it will take to deploy their own missiles across Central Asia in retaliation. Poland doesn't want the missiles. Europe either. The whole thing is an unnecessary escalation so President Warner Fox can show the world that he's a big man."
He couldn't argue with her assessment. Bunch is intent on being a part of that auction. But first, he has to acquire a relic.
Which one?
The lies had to be consistent. The nail in Bamberg.
That will be an easy take. It's just sitting there in the side chapel.
What do you know about the other relics? She shifted in the bed.
10 days ago, a team broke into the monastery of Santo Toribio de Liebana in Spain and took their true cross. I traced them back to Iran. 2 days after that, another team burglarized St. Anthony's Chapel in Pennsylvania and stole their thorn from the crown. The segment of the Pillar of the Flogging in Rome was taken last week. The Holy Sponge inside Notre Dame just 2 days ago. I've not been able to identify any of those thieves. The Russians took the holy blood today. Only the nail and lance remain.
She cocked her head and leaned forward, her soft lips approaching dangerously close to his. He raised a finger to stop her advance. Once he would have surrendered, when lust took control of good judgment and emotions ran on autopilot, all of it fueled by risk and anxiety. But he would not make that mistake again. He stood from the bed. Time for you to go. Her restless blue eyes bore testimony to a hit-and-run existence. She'd always been a hive of nerves. What she was doing right now seemed typical Sonia, playing both ends against the middle, using every weapon she had at her disposal. But he felt the tense atmosphere that had sprung up between them, as if neither believed a word the other said. They were definitely fencing, each tossing around a measured blend of fact and fiction.
She's a lucky woman.
More the other way around. She rose from the bed, her body just as impressive as he remembered. She slipped on her shoes and headed for the outer room and the door. He stood propped against the dresser, arms folded across his chest. She stopped and said, Take Ivan's warning seriously. Stay out of this one. It could get rough. As I recall, you liked it that way. She smiled. I do. And she left. Chapter 20. Wednesday, June 5th. Krakow, Poland. 11:50 a.m. Cotton admired Renek Gwówna. At over 600 feet on each side, the open expanse claimed the title of the largest medieval square in Europe. Its colorful perimeter buildings were all neoclassical, filled with every kind of shop, store, and eatery imaginable. A lot like Bruges, only much bigger. He'd contacted Stephanie after Sonia had left and told her he'd changed his mind and wanted in. Call him crazy, but he could no longer allow her to do this one on her own. So he'd packed his bag, slipped from the hotel by a back exit, then left in a car waiting at the ring road. He was driven south into Luxembourg, where he spent the night at an upscale hotel on the Magellan Billet's dime. He caught an early morning flight out to Frankfurt, where he changed planes on a tight connection to Bratislava. A car had been waiting in the parking lot, keys hidden inside, which he used to drive 200 miles north, across the open Poland-Slovakia border to Krakow. The roundabout route had been for Sonia's benefit, to keep him off any Polish radars. Krakow lay in a broad valley nestled close to the River Wisła. For centuries, it was Poland's capital and basked in richness and opulence. Old and new still mixed there in perfect harmony, with an almost mystical atmosphere, aided by the fact that the city escaped horrific bombing during World War II. The twin domes of St. Mary's Church rose into the clear late morning sky. Oddly, one tower was much shorter than the other, different in design and style, too, and he was sure there was a story in that somewhere. Stephanie had called on the drive through Slovakia and reported that the nail from Bamberg Cathedral had been stolen last night. That left only the Holy Lance. She'd also gone a bit old school and provided a packet of hard copy information, waiting in the car inside a manila envelope. He hadn't seen that in a while. Everything today was electronic. Along the way, he'd stopped and read what the envelope contained, learning the things he needed to know. A lance was first described in the Gospel of John. The Romans had wanted to break Jesus' legs, what they called cruri fragium, as a way to hasten death during crucifixion. But when it came time, they realized Jesus was already dead. To make sure that was the case, a soldier named Longinus supposedly stabbed Christ in the side with his lance, and immediately there came out blood and water. Which was why the Catholic Mass always included a mixing of the two. Blood symbolizing humanity, water, Christ's divinity. The confusion came from the many lances that claimed to be Longinus's original. One was in St. Peter's Basilica, but its provenance had always been suspect, its tip broken off and kept in Paris. Another could be found in Armenia, supposedly brought there by the Apostle Thaddeus. Antioch claimed one too, found after a monk had a vision that it was buried in a local church. The one that garnered the most attention sat in Vienna, inside the Hofburg. For centuries, Holy Roman emperors used it in their coronation ceremonies. When the empire disbanded in the early 19th century, the Habsburgs incorporated it into their imperial regalia. A legend associated with that lance said whoever possessed it held destiny in their hands. Hence its name, the Spear of Destiny. Charlemagne, Barbarossa, Napoleon, and Hitler had all craved it. Millions came to see it in Vienna every year. But testing in 2003 revealed it to be from the 7th century, not the time of Christ. Though an iron pin, hammered into the blade and set off by tiny brass crosses, long claimed to be from the crucifixion, was consistent in length and shape to a 1st century Roman nail. The fifth contender could be found in Krakow. It arrived 1,000 years ago, a gift from the Holy Roman Emperor Otto III to the Polish king Bolesław the Brave. Supposedly, it was a copy of the original that Charlemagne had possessed. It eventually acquired a name, the Spear of St. Maurice. When the Swedes invaded Poland in 1655, they robbed the treasury but left the spear, The Prussians and Austrians raided next, but did not take the spear. In 1785, the Germans claimed Poland and stole all of the imperial regalia, melting down the gold, but left the spear. Apparently, a simple black iron lance had no value. But to the Poles, it represented their spirit and independence. Hitler seized it in 1940 and had it taken to Vienna for comparison with the Spear of Destiny. Then, something odd happened. The Spear of St. Maurice was abruptly returned to Poland in 1944, which shocked everyone. Nazis never gave anything back. One theory hypothesized that the experts in Vienna recognized it as the real spear and returned it, wanting Hitler to have the fake, countering the legend of him holding destiny in his hands. Another story said the spears were switched and the fake was left in Austria, again so Hitler would be denied any mystical powers the artifact might contain. Either version seemed supported by the fact that Hitler failed in his quest, but Poland survived. No one knew anything for sure, which meant that Sonia might think the Hofburg and the Spear of Destiny to be the target, not Wawel Castle. Of course, he had no idea if her information about the auction was as solid as Stephanie's, but he had to assume that was the case. His instructions from the envelope were for him to come to Krakow's main square and enter the cloth market. Once the center of the medieval trade, the splendid Renaissance edifice had stood in Hrenek Główna since the 14th century. A Gothic rectangle the length of a football field, its inside was lined with stalls that sold every souvenir imaginable, while its outer arcades accommodated cafes and bars. Each end was open, people milling about through the covered space. He was told to head for the booth identified as number 135 and wait. He'd be approached and asked if he knew directions to the Krakow Academy. His reply? That it required a tram or bus, but walking might be faster, more old school. Oral passwords, then counter passwords. He hadn't used that one in a long time either. He stood outside one of the market's open ends and caught the sound of a trumpet in the air. The Hena, one of those long memory things, dating back to the 13th century when Mongols invaded Poland. A sentry on duty atop St. Mary's Church had sounded the alarm to close the city gates by playing a specific tune on his trumpet, but he was shot with an arrow in the throat and never completed the anthem. Still, the town woke from its slumber and repelled the invaders. Ever since, on the hour, the same five notes were sounded four times, one for each direction on the compass, from atop the church tower, always breaking off in mid-bar. Talk about tradition. He entered the cloth market and noticed that the booths, one after the other, were clearly numbered. He assumed he was coming to meet whoever had been doing the preliminary groundwork, preparing for the spear's theft. Probably the same person who'd arranged for the car and provided the manila envelope. It would be good to know more details, particularly since he'd arrived late to this party. He kept walking, paying attention to the merchandise and the shoppers. He seemed to fit right in, dressed in khakis and a button-down shirt with the sleeves rolled up. Once again, here he was, back in the game. At the booth marked 135, he slowed his pace and admired the hand-carved, brightly painted angels for sale. Three men immediately ringed him, blocking off any escape except through force. They were dressed casually, too, part of the crowd a moment ago. A fourth man approached. "Mr. Malone, please come with us." The group stood, like an island on the pavement, streams of people hurrying by on all sides. A familiar stirring raised his adrenaline. He decided that he could take these four. But first he asked, "And you are?"
"Agencia Viviadu. We're hoping you'll come along as a professional courtesy."
Polish Foreign Intelligence Agency. The big boys. Sonia's people. The guy added a smile to his request. Now he was intrigued.
"Where are we going?"
"Someone would like to speak with you."
So much for staying under the radar. Apparently, Polish intelligence knew everything he was doing. The smart play seemed the patient play. "Okay. Who am I to argue with courtesy?" Chapter 21. Jonty marveled at the castle's grand hall, a cavernous space topped by a magnificent timbered roof. Remnants of medieval paintings emerged in shadow all across the gray stone walls. Tracery windows broke the long expanse, but the ones high up at the two gabled ends, there only to illuminate the ceiling timbers, seemed unique. A railed gallery encased the hall on three sides, and past a thick stone balustrade, exposed the second floor. Seven pairs of chairs dotted the terrazzo floor, each beside a small wooden table. The communicated rules for the auction allowed two representatives for each bidder. Since there was bound to be animosity among the participants, the pairs of chairs were spaced apart. Each station came with a paddle. To further equalize matters, instead of numbers, common for auctions, each displayed the bidder's national colors. Russia, China, Germany, France, North Korea, Iran, and the United States. The rules likewise provided that no outside communication would be allowed and that all transmission signals in and out would be temporarily blocked. Vic had already installed a powerful jammer that would run all day Thursday until the auction ended. The event would begin at 11 a.m. with heavy hors d'oeuvres and drinks and should be over by 1 p.m., with everyone gone by 1:30. He, of course, would depart immediately after payment was confirmed. He'd already determined an escape route through the castle's back passages, where a car could be waiting to whisk him away. A single high-backed chair in the center faced the others, his place. He would personally conduct the auction from there. Vic would listen from above in the gallery and verify payment before the winner was declared. The only line of outside communication would be a laptop Vic would man in one of the second-floor bedrooms with a direct internet connection. A stout oak table stood just inside the double-doored entryway, empty at the moment, but tomorrow. Each bidder would deposit atop it their portion of the Arma Christi. During the cocktail party that would precede the auction, an expert he'd employed, at considerable cost, would verify each of the holy relics. He'd been assured there were markers that could be used to ensure authenticity, and the expert had spent the last 60 days preparing for a quick analysis. He had to guard against one of the bidders swapping out the original relic for a copy. He planned to sell all seven on the black market. He'd already determined a list of potential buyers. Combined, the seven relics could bring as much as 20 million euros. Clearly, somebody had placed a lid over any public acknowledgement of the thefts. Nothing had appeared in the media. Press reports from Bruges had reported only that a fire inside the basilica had caused a panic and required an evacuation. Not a word had come about the loss of the holy blood, though it had been noted that there would be no more venerations for the next 2 weeks while repairs were made. Similar accounts had come from the other four locations, which had closed off the public exhibition of their relics, too. Vic entered the hall and walked over to him. "I think we have everything in place," Jonty said, sweeping his arms out to embrace the grandeur around him. "The arrivals have all been coordinated," Vic said. To protect the auction site, each bidder had been provided a different path to a different location within 200 kilometers of where he stood. Seven teams of two people each had been hired to chauffeur each pair of participants. His former profession had aided that recruitment, as he'd been able to locate and retain 14 highly capable and trustworthy individuals. His biggest fear was that one of the bidders would order a preemptive strike. A risk, for sure. Killing him before the auction was certainly in some of the bidders' best interests, but it was equally not so with others. The idea was to play those competing interests against one another and keep everyone off center. The instructions to all seven invitees had made clear that nothing they were bidding upon was located on site. The winning bidder would be told where to go to find what they bought, information that would only be provided once payment was confirmed. He wanted this sale to go perfectly, and he wanted to be alive afterward to enjoy the spoils without worry of reprisals. Germany's loitering was a problem. but the United States' hesitation had become worrisome. Less than 12 hours remained for an RSVP. Weeks ago, he'd personally called President Fox, who'd assured him that America would participate. What's a few million dollars? A small price to pay to bring the Russians to their knees. And besides, it's not my money. They'd both laughed at the quip. Fox had always been a dealer, really good at using other people's money. They'd done business a couple of times in the past when Fox had needed the kind of close information that helped cinch a tough business deal. Now the man was the President of the United States, calling for missiles to be placed in Poland. What luck. So he'd taken a chance and made personal contact, revealing both himself and some of what he possessed. Fox had been ecstatic and offered to preempt the sale with a 50 million euro offer. But he'd declined, knowing the auction would bring more. Had Fox changed his mind on participating? The nail was taken last night, Vic said. But oddly, the Germans have not RSVP'd as yet. That was strange. They have time. I'm sure we'll hear from them. Arrangements are in place, Vic said, for the five invitees already en route to spend the night at their respective locales. I'll deal with the other two when we hear from them. They will all be transported tomorrow morning simultaneously. Everyone should be here on site by 11:30. Damn the United States, he muttered. Vic said nothing, knowing that the comment was not intended to elicit a reply. He worked hard to keep his good-mannered poise, but a powerful nervous energy had taken hold of him. Usually he could control it with harmless outlets like reading, and he prided himself on being able to pace his emotions, whatever the pressure. But this was different. Really different. Is our guest below quiet? He asked, referring to the spy in the basement. I had to gag him. Probably better. We don't want the staff knowing he's there. All have been told that the basement is off limits. Luckily, these people ask few questions. With what I'm paying, they should be discreet. We're going to have to be extra vigilant, Vic. We will be. I have video surveillance set up outside to watch the main entrance. Each team of drivers bringing the bidders will make sure they come with no weapons, electronic devices, or GPS tags. None of which will help us if there's a damn drone in the air following those cars, he said. None of these participants have the ability to deploy a high-altitude drone within the sovereign airspace of Slovakia. Not even the U.S. That doesn't mean they won't try. But the mountains and hilly terrain should work to our benefit. And we've set up some surprises along the way to deal with the possibility. Good to hear. His cell phone vibrated. Keep at it, he said to Vic, motioning for him to leave. He answered the call. Good day, Jonty, the voice said. Oh, no. Reinhardt.
Chapter 22 Cotton stared at the monastery of the Camaldolese monks. The white limestone building, topped by spires and a green copper roof, sat on Srebrna Gora, Silver Mountain, a few miles west of Krakow, amid trees and vineyards overlooking the river Wisła. Monks had lived here in solitude for nearly five centuries. But what were he and his Polish escorts doing here? They'd parked at the bottom of the hill, a solid two football fields walk up an inclined road, both sides walled. The path ended at an arched doorway flanked on both sides by two tall towers topped with more green copper spires. He'd decided that since his entire presence had been compromised, nothing would be gained by resistance. Better to see where this trail led. So he'd come along willingly, curious about who wanted to have a chat. Apparently, it was also to be a private talk, as this place was about as secluded as they came. One of his minders stepped up to the portal and pulled an iron ring attached to a long chain. A few moments later, the stout plank door opened. A man appeared, dressed in a hooded white robe and sporting a long bushy beard. He appraised them, nodded, then indicated they could enter. Not a word was spoken. They passed through the gatehouse and entered a grassy courtyard with no trees or adornments. A concrete path led to the main doors of a huge church. At least a couple of hundred feet stretched to the top of its copper spire, the pristine limestone walls bright in the midday sun. Another white-robed monk waited at the doors. Cotton's two escorts stopped and gestured that he should continue alone. He entered the church, and the monk left, closing the door behind him. The interior was a spacious single nave with a barrel-vaulted ceiling. A true Catholic sanctuary, rich in style, both sides lined with impressive Baroque chapels. The main altar at the far end was spectacular. Bright sun broke through the windows in fine streams of dusty light. No one was inside, save for one man, kneeling in the first pew facing the altar. An eerie figure, backlit by candles. The whole scenario, he supposed, an attempt to deepen the hush and tighten the nerves. The man crossed himself, then stood and calmly walked down the center aisle. He was tall, heavy-chested, and handsome, in his 50s. A thin mat of brown hair brushed straight back from a wide forehead. He was clean-shaven, with a jawline tight as a clamp, dressed in a finely cut blue-gray suit. "Mr. Malone, I'm Janusz Czakowski." A hand was extended, which he shook. "I thought it best we speak in person," the President of Poland said in perfect English. "And this place offers us absolute privacy. You can't say that about many spots in this world. By the way, you don't speak Polish, do you?" He shook his head. "That's one language I never mastered. Italian, Danish, Spanish, Latin, German. I can handle those." "I was told you have a perfect memory." "I don't know about that, but details do stick with me. Eidetic is the term used to describe it. Are you friends with the monks?"
"I like to think so."
"They are a most impressive people," Czakowski said, staying with English. "They follow a severe code of self-imposed principles, all governed by ora et labora and memento mori." He translated the Latin. "Pray and work. Remember you must die." How practical. And depressing.
"It works for them. They only talk to one another 3 times a week, and interact with the world beyond this monastery just 5 days a year.
Except when the president of the country comes for a visit." Czakowski smiled.
"That title does open doors. The prior and I are old friends."
"That helps too."
"Life here is simple. Between prayer and work, they consume only vegetarian meals eaten in the solitude of their own small hermitage, where the only piece of decor is the skull of the previous prior. Can you imagine that? But I know for a fact that it is true." This man was clearly leading to something, so he let him stay at the head of the parade.
"We don't know each other, Mr. Malone, but I'm told you're a reasonable man. I want you to take a message back to the people in Washington."
There it was again. Errand boy. But an interesting choice of words. Not to the president or the White House. To the people in Washington.
"When I was a child," Czakowski said, "one day my mother received a phone call. It lasted only a few seconds. But after she hung up, she told me and my brother to get our coats. While we did, she grabbed some rope and a few cloth bags. Then we headed into town. She took us to a local store where we found a big stack of toilet paper, rolls and rolls of it on the floor. We had not seen so much toilet paper in a long time. She grabbed as many rolls as she could, threading the rope through the center, tying the ends, and draping them around my and my brother's necks. She was hurrying as fast as she could before others arrived. Once that happened, it would not be long before all that toilet paper was gone. We called it hunting, not shopping. Hunting. Because you never knew exactly what you'd bring home. Toilet paper was rare, Mr. Malone, a precious commodity. When it became available, you had to secure all you could. We had a small bidet in our bathroom, and when we were fortunate enough to have running water, we could clean ourselves. If not..." The president paused. "I leave that to your imagination.
That was life under the communists, where even toilet paper was rationed. That was Poland before 1990. He could see the pain in the man's eyes as he remembered. Shortages were a way of life. Sometimes they were real, just a scarcity of goods. But most times, and this is important, most times they were engineered by the government as a means of control. You could not buy anything without ration cards, and you could only get ration cards if you registered your identity with the government. Later on, the shortages were blamed on Solidarity and their strikes as a way to turn the people against the movement. But by then, we all knew the truth, which all had to have been horrible, and he sympathized. Still, why am I here?
An excellent question. Why are you here in Kraków?
You know the answer.
That's right, I do. You've come to gain your way into an auction, where you want to buy damaging information about me.
As sleazy as that sounded, the man was right. But there was a little more to it. I'm here to help a friend. Tchaikovsky appeared puzzled.
Who?
An old friend who's in a tight situation. Lucky for her she has you. Did I say it was a her?
No, you didn't.
You're well informed.
I try to be.
And what of me, Mr. Malone? Do I pay the price for you helping a friend?
I suppose you would.
He hated saying it. Tchaikovsky paced a moment. I told you about the toilet paper so you would know that my parents were loyal to the government. But it was not out of any love or support. My parents were loyal out of fear. They realized something vitally important to surviving in the Poland of their day. A simple maxim. The law is whatever the government says it is. Not what is written. Not what is known. But what they say it is. Period. No discussion. No appeal. Many of their friends, who never realized that truth, disappeared in the night. Taken by the government. Gone. It happened all the time. He could only imagine the horror that life had been. But I survived. And here I am, president of the nation. Why am I here? He asked again.
I thought that was obvious. I don't want you to complete your mission.
Which apparently has been severely compromised. I'm curious. How did you know where to find me?
That's easy, a new voice said.
He turned back toward the altar and saw a man enter the nave.
I told him, Tom Bunch said.
Chapter 23. Jonty was troubled by the cell phone call, since it came from the one man he'd been hoping to avoid. With no choice, he'd left the castle with Vic, driving south to Košice, Slovakia's second-largest city. The town was a gem, its main street lined by colorful burger houses and palaces, the cobbled square one of Slovakia's most beautiful, dominated by the Cathedral of St. Elizabeth. The caller had requested a face-to-face meeting, instructing that they connect at a hotel just off the square. He entered the building and headed for a small restaurant. Vic waited in the lobby to make sure that there were no more surprises. The man he sought sat at a table alone, the cafe a dim inside room with no windows. He stared at Augustus Eli Reinhard V. What a name. Sounded like a crown prince. He lived, of all places, in Liechtenstein, a tiny principality landlocked in Central Europe, squished between Switzerland and Austria. It had one of the highest gross domestic product per person ratios in the world. Its claim to fame as a tax haven for rich people.
Like Reinhardt.
His competitor was in his early 60s, but looked younger, an utterly punctilious individual with a clipped mustache and a knife-edge crease in his trousers. He wore a pressed blazer over a starched white shirt with no tie. Jonty's well-trained nose caught the waft of expensive blue tobacco mixed with sweet cologne.
A Mont Blanc pen rested in the shirt pocket, and he noticed the distinctive top. A 1998 Edgar Allan Poe writer's edition. Midnight blue marble resin base with gold-plated mountings and a gold nib. 18 karat, if he wasn't mistaken. A collector's piece, worth several thousand dollars. And this guy carried it around like a cheap ballpoint. Reinhard stood as he approached the table. They gazed at each other with open curiosity, gauging, judging, wondering, before each cautiously offered a hand to shake. They'd only actually come face to face about a dozen times over the past decade. None of those encounters particularly pleasant. "So good of you to come, Jonty, and on such short notice." The tone was soft and polite. "Was there an option?" he asked. "Oh, let's not look at it that way. That seems so coercive. Please, have a seat. Would you like anything to drink?" He waved off the offer. "Get to the point, Eli." They both sat. "I want in." Those were the three words he'd most dreaded. There were perhaps half a dozen legitimate information brokers in the world, including himself and Reinhardt. If they were ranked, he liked to think of himself as the best, with Eli a distant second. Of course, the man sitting across from him would have a different opinion. Regardless, Reinhardt knew the business, and clearly possessed some excellent intel as to what was about to happen. But he decided to stay coy, nonetheless. "In on what?" Reinhardt reached down to the floor and brought up a small leather case. He unzipped the top and removed a battered iron spike a few centimeters long. "I had this stolen from the chapel of the Holy Nail in Bamberg Cathedral last night. The reliquary there is now empty. They are really quite careless in how it's displayed, just sitting out in the open, waiting for someone to take it. I believe they have closed the chapel for renovations." So much for hoping this was all a bluff. "You were counting on the Germans stealing this spike, then responding to your invitation. That won't be happening. They opted not to participate in your auction and graciously allowed me the opportunity to take their place."
"And why would they do that?"
"Because I supplied them with some information that they desperately wanted. In return, they provided me with information on your auction." "They don't want to participate." Reinhardt replaced the nail into the leather bag. "They have greater interests at the moment. So they were more than willing to offer their spot to me. Proxies aren't allowed. I'm not a proxy. I'm taking their place. This is my deal, Eli, not yours. Leave it alone." "It was your deal. Now it's our deal." This couldn't be happening. Everything he'd planned depended on motivations. He'd chosen the seven participants with great care, intent on playing one off the other. The U.S. and Russia were simple, opposite sides to the same coin. Iran was with Russia, since they would be the target of any missiles. China and North Korea had been included since each wanted leverage on both Russia and the United States. That left Germany and France. Both had previously opposed any missiles in Europe, and both were now engaged in open political conflict with the United States. The new American president had gone out of his way to antagonize them. Relations among the three nations had turned frosty, with a trade war looming. He assumed that having something to bargain with would be a good thing for either government, enough that they'd be willing to pay. Not as much as the others, but enough to help drive the price higher. "How is this now our deal?" he asked.
"We'll get to that. First, I sent a man to check on you. His name is Art Munoz. He disappeared. Do you by chance have him?"
"I do."
Reinhardt pointed. "You're a clever one, Jonty. As is Vic DeGenti. I told Munoz to be careful. I assumed you took him. That's why I decided to come in person. Please, Eli, I'm asking as a colleague that you leave this alone. It's my deal and mine alone. Reinhardt had interfered before, undercutting his arrangements with potential clients, selling information cheaper, even sabotaging three deals that he knew about. Given the clandestine nature of their business, a certain amount of aggressive competition was to be expected, but Reinhardt had a habit of taking it to an extreme. Jonty had tolerated the prior interference, since there was plenty for everyone. But this was different.
I'll admit, when I first heard of your auction, I was jealous, Reinhardt said. Quite a thing you managed to orchestrate. Bold, unique, the potential for an enormous profit.
But it's short-sighted, Jonty.
How so?
Reinhardt sat back in his chair. My German friends alerted me to something you apparently do not know. Now he was intrigued.
Ever heard of the spiżarnia? It's Polish for the pantry.
I have no idea what that is.
Then today is a good day for you, Jonty. Like Christmas in June.
Augustus Eli Reinhardt V's lips broke into a big smile.
I've come bearing gifts, my friend. Gifts that will make us both quite wealthy.
Chapter 24 Cotton held his temper as Tom Bunch marched down the center aisle, as if headed for a coronation. You set me up? The annoying little creature shrugged. It had to be done. He'd deal with this imbecile later. Right now he had the President of Poland to contend with.
A short while ago I spoke with President Fox, Tchaikovsky said. I explained to him I do not want American missiles based here. I told him I would never approve such a measure. I asked him politely not to force the issue. Do you know what he said to me?
He could only imagine.
He told me that he fully understood my reservations and that he would not pressure me.
A surprising comment, considering what had been said by Bunch in Bruges.
President Fox also informed me that you were headed to Krakow and told me the rendezvous point.
Which I provided to President Fox, Bunch added.
That's how we knew to be in the cloth market at booth 135, Tchaikovsky said. I told President Fox that we would deal with you. He had no problem with that, and his personal envoy has been of great assistance.
Bunch pointed.
Poland has been informed that you are working independently for a division within the Justice Department that has no authority to be here. That division, the Magellan Billet, has embarrassed the United States with its unauthorized actions relative to any supposed auction of information. The White House was unaware of all this, until today. Once we learned of the situation, we intervened to stop what's happening.
He sucked a few deep breaths and kept his cool at Bunch's lie.
And the auction? He calmly asked. America will not be participating, Bunch said. That's not the way we do things. Of course, the people who sent you think differently, but we'll deal with them shortly.
Doubt and suspicion surrounded him like an aura.
Everybody here was lying to one another.
Are you satisfied with those assurances? He asked Tchaikovsky.
I am. President Fox was emphatic and apologetic. He told me he will be withdrawing his missile proposal within the next 48 hours. He asked for a little time to deal with his military, who want those weapons here. I understood that reservation and agreed to that time.
48 hours. Past the auction. Just enough time to rock this man to sleep.
Where's Stephanie? He asked Bunch. On her way back to the United States. She'll be fired tomorrow, since she's the one who sent you here unauthorized. We've given President Tchaikovsky our personal assurance that she will no longer be a part of the American intelligence community in any way whatsoever.
Two birds with one stone. Absolutely. Not only were they lying to a head of state, but they were going to sacrifice Stephanie to prove the point. That way Fox got everything he'd wanted on Inauguration Day. No Stephanie. No Magellan Billet.
That auction will go on. With or without the United States, Cotton said.
That's true.
And we will deal with that, Tchaikovsky said.
It is a Polish matter for our resolution. But thankfully, the value of the information being offered for sale will be greatly diminished with America's withdrawal. I'm grateful to Mr. Bunch and to President Fox for making that happen. He knew little to nothing about Tchaikovsky, but anyone who managed to win a national election, especially one in volatile Poland, could not be as naive as Bunch and Fox thought him to be, especially with someone as smart as Sonia Draga working for him. Cotton realized that Tchaikovsky might be playing along in this game, his acquiescence all a facade. But Tom Bunch's face and squinty eyes telegraphed that he believed the Poles had been placated. "What now?" he asked. "You're going back to Denmark," Bunch said. "I'll personally escort you. Hopefully, our friends here in Poland will forgive this transgression and we all will move on." "I have assured President Fox," Tchaikovsky said, "that all will be forgiven. I appreciate his candor and discretion in this matter of the auction, and his decision to not pressure Poland on the missiles." "He's a great guy," Cotton said, his sarcasm evident. "What a pal." Bunch frowned. "I apologize, Mr. President. This man does not know his place or how to show proper respect. We'll leave you now, with the United States' sincere thanks for your understanding." Tchaikovsky stood in the church and watched as Tom Bunch and Cotton Malone disappeared out the main doors, which one of the robed brothers closed as he left, too. "What do you think?" he called out.
"I think Bunch is a terrible liar," Sonia said.
She'd been secluded inside one of the confessionals, out of sight, but able to hear everything. She stepped out.
"As is the President of the United States," Tchaikovsky said. "No better than the damn communists."
"Cotton is being used. He won't like that. It's not his nature."
He was curious.
"How well do you know Malone?"
She grinned, her teeth like a row of pearls.
"Are you jealous?"
"Should I be?"
"It was a long time ago, before you."
He stepped close and took her into his arms, kissing her softly on the lips.
"I just might be a little jealous."
"That's something new from you. I like it."
"I need you on this,"
he whispered to her. "You're the only one I can trust."
"I'm the only one you have."
That was true. His wife would be the last person he'd involve, and there was no way he would recruit Michał Zima and the BOR beyond what he'd already had them do. Too many people to trust with too much that could go wrong. He and Sonia had carried on a private relationship for over a year, one that had grown increasingly close. He loved her flashing wit, quick apprehension, and genuine affection. She was a smart, dynamic woman who challenged him in every way. He understood he had no right to demand anything from her, given he was still married, but she'd knowingly offered her love and emotions. She was regarded as the AW's best operative, her abilities and discretion never in question. Nor was her loyalty. If he didn't know better, he'd swear she loved him.
"What will they do?" he asked, still holding her.
"Bunch thinks you're satisfied. A personal assurance from the President of the United States is enough to calm your fears. So he'll have Cotton go after the relic tonight."
There was only one relic left to claim. With Malone in Krakow, America's ticket into the auction had to be the Spear of St. Maurice.
"The Russians still don't know the auction location," she said. "It will take place tomorrow, and their two representatives are en route. But it appears to be a roundabout method, a stopgap location. They're headed for Bratislava, told they'll be transported elsewhere tomorrow. If America is going to get in, Cotton has to move fast."
Tchaikovsky had known from the start that his options were limited. The Polish constitution provided no directly elected presidential line of succession. If the president died or resigned, then the Marshal of Parliament became acting president for 60 days, until elections were called. The current marshal was a weak and ineffective man, the type of leader Poland spawned all too often, ones who sought far too much outside help to make themselves strong. That had never worked before, and would not now.
If a resignation was forced, his immediate successor would do exactly what Fox wanted, no question. Once done, it would be hard to undo. So anyone who came after that might continue to placate Washington. That meant he had to deal with the problem here and now. But his past stood in the way.
How do you know Malone will still steal the spear?
Because of Stephanie, Nell. He's loyal to her. He'll do whatever is necessary to protect her. That's his nature. Like he said, he's here to help a friend.
You sound like you admire him.
I do. Men like that are a rarity.
Should I be insulted?
Not at all. You're at the head of that rare list. Poland is fortunate to have you as its president. We need to keep you there. She paused. Whatever it takes. He smiled at her confidence.
What will you do?
Our Russian associates were forthcoming in Bruges to get my help with Cotton. But they've told me little since. They don't want us anywhere near that auction. But we need to be there. And Cotton is our way in. So I'll be there tonight, waiting for him.
Chapter 25. Jonty could not decide if Eli was being serious or working him. His competitor had the resources to learn whatever he wanted, definitely comparable to his own, along with the nerve to explore dark corners where others might hesitate to tread. Eli, being here in Slovakia, was proof positive of that. But was this offer simply more drama?
What are you talking about, Eli? What kind of gifts do you have?
This Bijarnia. I learned about it from my friends in the German government. It was a precautionary measure taken by Moscow in the 1990s, when Soviet rule ended and the Polish Republic re-emerged.
A precautionary measure against what?
Hypocrisy, I'm told.
An odd reply. But he could see that Eli was enjoying himself.
Jonty, you have incriminating information on one man, the current president of Poland. Information that relates back to his time as a young solidarity worker. It clearly has blackmail value. But imagine if you had that same kind of information on other people, many of whom, like Tchaikovsky, have risen to positions of influence, some in government, some in private industry. How much would the Americans pay for that? Or the Russians? How much would the people involved pay for it to stay secret? The pantry offers us an opportunity to find out.
Now he was curious.
What is it? Not so fast. I came here to make a deal. And contrary to what you might think, I actually want to make a fair deal.